Another thing we did is we went to Auschwitz. And I had wanted to do this. I'm sure some of my relatives died there. I don't know who or what, because all four of my grandparents came. One was from Poland, one was from Ukraine, and the other two, I'm not sure if they were from Russia or Belarus or Ukraine. Anyway, as soon as I told people there that my grandparents were from there, everybody thought that was wonderful. It established this incredibly close bond right away. Your grandparents are from Ukraine. Your grandparents are from Poland. Wow. You know. Anyway, so we went to Auschwitz on a rainy, muddy spring day, completely fitting for going there. And it was really something going there. I had been to Dachau before, many years ago. But Auschwitz was the real big one. And there were many camps around Auschwitz. It wasn't just one camp. The big one that had the big gas chamber and the big crematorium, that wasn't where they had the tourist program. You know, the tourist program, we only saw a small gas chamber and a few small crematoriums. And the labor camp and the gallows where they hung people and the prison within the concentration camp. You know, like if you went to the bathroom when you weren't excused from doing your labor, they threw you in prison. They had some prisons where they made everybody stand up. The cell was so small you couldn't sit down, you had to stand up. And just unbelievable things. And at that point, you know, and mind you, all throughout this whole trip, I'm hearing about the war. And it really hit me. I mean, I have this theory. That I don't think Europeans and people of European descent, white people in general, have come to terms with the fact that the Holocaust happened and was perpetuated by white people, and that it's seen as like Hitler was a fluke, and Stalin was a fluke, and Yugoslavia is a fluke, because really white people don't do barbarian things. Only Mao Zedong does that, and in Somalia, they're killing each other, you know. It's like people of other races do all these horrible things, but when it happens with white people, it's just because there's some crazy person. And, I mean, this is my theory, that somehow in Europe and North America, we haven't really confronted the barbarianism of our own culture. Because, I mean, it was just incredible when you go to Auschwitz and you know. And I had seen Schindler's List right before I left, so everything was quite fresh in the mind. And Krakow was where Schindler's List had occurred, you know, so I saw the places of where all this had happened. And quite amazing. And I was pretty okay kind of going through, you know, as okay as you can be going through there, until we got to one room that was filled with suitcases. Because when the people were taken from the ghetto, first they were moved from their houses into a ghetto, and then they were taken from a ghetto to the concentration camp. And they were told that they were just being moved to another area where they'd have a new house. So pack up your things, label your suitcases, put your name big and your address and some identification mark so that your luggage can reach you later. Of course, you know, as soon as the people got on the train, the luggage was taken away and separated and sold, and those people never saw it again. And there was a whole room full of suitcases with people's names on it. People who were killed in the camp, who thought that they were getting relocated and they were going to get their possessions back. And what really got to me is the names in the suitcases are the names of a lot of people I know. You know, but family names are the names of a lot of people that you hear, you know, in America. And it just really brought it very much home, kind of what had happened. That room really got to me. And another room got to me, where they had a whole long, huge display filled with women's hair that after they had gassed the people, then they sent the young, healthy Jewish boys into the ones who were strong to go in there and cut the people's hair. And there were braids, you know, women's braids or hair. And it was all used to stuff mattresses, to stuff overcoats. that kind of got to me too. It was really quite incredible. If you ever get a chance to go, you must go as a tourist. Anyway, so we went to Auschwitz. We also went, the morning right before I left, we went to the Jewish section of the city, you know, where the whole thing with Schindler's List had occurred. And there were all these old, and the whole Jewish section of the city is completely, it's like a slum now, because they moved the Jews out, and they moved other people in, and then the whole area just kind of disintegrated. It's a really, really poor section. There's a lot of vacant buildings there. And as we were walking around, I mean, it was really like a slum. And Ava, the woman we stayed with, said, you know, she said, when I was little, right after the war, everybody lived like this. You know, that's how bad conditions were. Now only a few people. And we went into the Jewish cemetery, and one man took us around. And it was so weird because he was Muslim. I couldn't figure out what a Muslim man from Turkey was doing, leading tourists from a Jewish cemetery. Very, very strange. And it was interesting because there they did very much what had happened in Tibet too. They took like the scriptures that had been written on the tombstones and put them on the pavement for people to walk on. That's exactly what the communists did in Tibet with the Mani stones, put them on the pavement, made people walk on holy things. Anyway, so we went there, and then I taught at the university one night in Krakow, and we were there over Easter weekend. And so on Good Friday, we went into one of the churches and saw the church ceremony on Good Friday and kind of went to a few churches that evening. And then the other two nights I taught in the home, you know, where we were living, because these people no longer had a Dharma center. And then Tenzin Palmo and I said we wanted to go to the Dharma center because this group had split off, you know, because we thought that it was very important to kind of go there and show that from our side, you know, there's no animosity and that other Buddhist teachers from various traditions didn't have horns on their head and they were friendly people. And, you know, so we went there and these people were a little bit cold, but they were civil and they were friendly. So I thought that that was, you know, like a real token of goodwill to go visit their center. A very nice connection with the people in Poland. Very, very good connection. I really love the Poles. They're very, very friendly and kind. But again, it really hit home because we sat around at breakfast talking a lot about different things. And the man in the house, he said to me at one point, you know, you come from America. Do you have any idea what it's like to have your country occupied by another country? Do you have any idea what it's like to live under communism? Now, do you have any idea what it's like to have your country's borders rearranged by other countries at their own discretion? Because the borders of Poland have changed. I mean, if you look at the map, where Poland was before World War One, I mean, it wasn't really before World War One. Where it was after World War One, where it was after World War, the borders were incredibly different, you know? And it was all rearranged by other forces. And Poles who lived in Poland before the war, that part was occupied by, you know, because Stalin and Hitler partitioned Poland. And, you know, they each occupied their own part. And the part that Stalin occupied, he got in there, he deported the Poles to Siberia and to Central Asia, you know. And then after the war, the Silesia, which was a German-Polish area, Russia gave that to Poland, and the Germans were deported to Poland. And so, again, you have all this ethnic groups moving back and forth, and the population of the place changing drastically within a few years. And it was also very interesting as you went from country to country, learning people's different version of this of the thing. Because the Poles felt that Poland was taken over by Russia and now it's incorporated into Ukraine, you know, and Belarus. But of course you get to Ukraine and they say, well, part of Ukraine was under Polish control for many years and now we got it back. And the Poles were saying, oh, now we have Silesia back. That's our territory. And then I stopped in Germany on the way back. And they said, oh, this was German land. And you know, Stalin gave it to the Poles after the war. So it's very interesting to see different countries' versions of history and who, you know, what belonged to who. And how you just travel a few miles and you come to a different ethnic group. You know? Okay, so from Krakow, then I went to Warsaw. Warsaw was completely a mess after the war. When the Germans left, they bombed the place. In fact, it was supposed to be even more destroyed than it already was, but some of the Polish resistance people had found some of the, I think it must have been TNT, that was underground, that was supposed to blow up even more parts of the city. They had found it and diffused it. But already, you know, the city was just completely in rubble after the war. And I mean, I thought about it in so many places I went to where the places were destroyed. How did people manage after the war? You know, okay, all of a sudden you have peace. The Germans withdraw. The Russians come in. There's no infrastructure. You can't get building materials. You don't know who's in charge, where the police are, where the post office is. How do you get food? How do you rebuild the country when it's total chaos after the place has been bombed? You know, I mean, the people, they're incredibly courageous what they've done in rebuilding these places. Also, in Warsaw, we went to the area of the Warsaw Uprising, because in 1943 there had been a big uprising in the Jewish ghetto, and the people had really fought back against the Germans. And it's so weird, you go there and there's a big ghetto monument to the ghetto uprising, and there's all these new apartment blocks all around. It's like a monument and a big park and then apartment blocks all around. And then you go over to one of these places nearby and they have photos of what the place looked like after the uprising, and the whole place was total rubble, complete rubble. The buildings were flat, I mean flat. And that's why all the new buildings there right now. And I found out His Holiness had gone there. He had gone to this monument. He had gone to another monument also in the city and done some prayers. And he had gone to Auschwitz as well. And I also found out at Auschwitz that it wasn't just for the Jews. Auschwitz was initially made for the German part, for the Polish partisans who were against German occupation. And so actually 3 million Poles were killed in the concentration camps as well. Actually 6 million Poles, 3 million were Jewish, and 3 million were, I guess, the Catholic Poles, were killed during the war. And then we went to the Jewish cemetery, and we get off, we go into the Jewish cemetery, and this is the cemetery for centuries, you know, it's really, I mean, it's all overgrown and all these old tombstones written in Hebrew, and you could walk from, you know, it's really huge. We couldn't even see once we entered the barriers, and there's these old trees and leaves all over the place. It's all overgrown and tombstones every which way. And there's three buses from United Jewish Appeal there, from America. Three buses full of American Jewish women going to visit the Jewish cemetery. And we're walking along, and what we hear one woman, she was an older woman, and she was saying that she had been in the Warsaw Uprising. And she was coming back now, and she was going to look for the tombs of some of her friends who had been killed during. And, you know, we start walking around there, and all of a sudden I just have this image of my parents coming there. And then I nearly lost it, you know, because I think that place would be so painful for my parents that it would just be unreal. That kind of was very moving. Quite an incredible place. Where else did we go in Warsaw? We walked around the old cities, the Field City. And my friend Mary met me in Warsaw. One friend, you know how I had told you before I went, I said, anybody who wants to come with me is welcome. Nobody took me up on it. And I said the same thing to my friend Mary, and she took me up on it. So she met me in Warsaw, and when we were together for 2 weeks during the trip, which was really wonderful. And she saw, I didn't see, but she saw in the Old City a couple of swastikas. That really alarmed her. And I asked one man about it, and he said, yeah, it's true, there is a rise in anti-Semitism all over Eastern Europe, but it's anti-Semitism without the Jews, because there aren't any Jews left. You know, there just aren't any left, but they still hate them. Quite amazing. And the group in Warsaw was a lovely group, and this is one of the places I had the best connections with the group of people. Lovely people. They were so friendly. We met in one guy's flat. He was a dentist, and his dream was to go and work for the Tibetan community in India and Nepal and fill everybody's teeth. I told him he'd never be out of work. And so we stayed at his place, and everybody came over in the evenings, and the room was probably about this big. And there were 40 people in it. Everybody was squished in together, very happy. You know, nobody could move. They asked lots of questions. They wanted me to talk about emotions. And so we had lots of talks about guilt. I mean, what to talk about in Catholic country? Guilt. You know, they didn't fall asleep during that one. You know, we talked about despair and fear and anger. You know, they really wanted to hear about this. And then again, I talked about refuge, because their center was also traumatized by this splitting. But a lovely, lovely group of people. And they get a lot of teachers in Poland. Several other teachers have gone there too. But they kind of get, you know, little blotches here and there of different people teaching. So it's hard for them to get like an overall global view of what Buddhism is about. And I think, you know, if I went back to that part of the world, what I'd do is go back and, because this time I was going 2 days here and 3 days there, is go back and go fewer places but lead retreats. So you could really work with a group of people over a period of time and get them, you know, solidified and going somewhere. Okay, so now we're done with Eastern Europe and we're moving into the former Soviet Union. So we, you know, we took this train from Warsaw to Vilnius, and it is bleak and it's raining. And we go through a little section of Belarus, and the guy looks at our Russian visas, and he marches us up to the front of the train, makes us take our jackets, stamps the visas, and marches us back. And and we arrive in Vilnius. And this was the beginning of a surreal, I cannot even begin to describe to you what being in the former Soviet Union is like and what we encounter. I can't even begin to give you the flavor of it. There was one man, the places in Eastern Europe, I had called those places myself and arranged and sent them letters. And then there was one man in Petersburg who was supposed to organize the former Soviet Union and all the places. And the day before I left, he sent me an itinerary because I pushed and pushed and threatened not to come unless I had an itinerary. Sent it to me the day before I left. He never sent Alex itineraries for his things. But I was really glad that I pushed. The teaching in Vilnius, and Alex called the guy in Vilnius who was supposed to double-check my whole itinerary in former Soviet Union to make sure that the guy in Petersburg had done it all right. And so the guy in Vilnius knew all my dates, everything, where I was going, where and where, and you know. Anyway, he didn't organize the teaching in Vilnius until 3 days before I came. And the room where I was supposed to give the talk wasn't confirmed until the morning that I was giving the talk. The only publicity that was done was the night before at another group had done a big Tibet support group thing, and there were over 100 people at that, and I gave a little talk there about Tibet. They wanted me to do that. That was an impromptu thing. And the only publicity for my talk was an announcement given at the end of that. This is how well organized it was after they were supposed to do all this organization. And the scene in Lithuania, it's very strange. A lot of several people had gone to Buryat. Buryat is a Mongol people, like a branch of the Mongols, and Buryatia is around Lake Baikal. It's north of Mongolia, and it's in Russian territory. So it's within Russia itself. There are some ethnically Buddhist areas, and this was one of them. So some Lithuanians had gone there to study. Now, Buddhism in Buryatia, you know, this place above Mongolia, had been very, very flourishing until the time of the communist takeover. And then, you know, of course, the monasteries were closed in the 30s when Stalin did his little number. He did a real good number there and killed lots of people, lots of monks. And so the monasteries, you know, maybe there were one or two token ones where they studied Tibetan medicine. And everybody basically went underground, and most of the monks got married. And then as things loosened up, some of them came back to live at the monasteries, and they brought their wives with them and their vodka with them. And so I kept hearing stories about in Buryatia, all the drunken monks with their vodka doing tantric puja. You know, because there's one tantric puja where you have a little bit of alcohol, you take a drop on your fingertip. Well, they did it bigger and better, and you took a lot of alcohol. And anyway, there was this one lama there who taught a lot of people in Buryatia, and he was the first one to teach Europeans. So people from Lithuania, from Russia, had gone to Buryatia and studied with him. And he was very controversial, and I still do not at all have a clear picture of him, because some people I talked to said, this guy is a great yogi, his texts are wonderful, he's very profound, he taught people, you know, really on an individual basis, and was an excellent teacher. And other people said, this guy, complete loony, he was drinking, he was advocating sex, he was totally, you know, off the wall. And and you got these two very, very divergent views on one person, you know. And this, I was soon to discover, was very common. That so many places I went, I got completely different views on a certain group or a certain person. And the views were always very polarized. One group liked and the other group hated. So it really started there, and I saw it on and on as I went to different places, as people talked about teachers, as they talked about different groups. And so it's very difficult to get clear information, even clear facts on what actually was going on and what happened and who this guy was, who anybody was, and what was really going on, because you got such different stories in different places you went. And I realized that this is what people are going to write doctoral PhD theses on. You know, what I was listening to as basic gossip, you know, they gossip about this guy and they gossip about that guy and talk about everything over lunch. This is what people are going to do historical research and write their theses on, you know, and research all the gossip of who was what to try and figure out what really happened. It's very interesting to figure that out, but that's what PhD thesis is on. Excuse me. Turn the tape recorder off. But Lithuania, they had, like I said, this one group had organized a very strong Tibet support group meeting, which I spoke at, and then there were other speakers, and they just had a big meeting in Delhi of Tibet's parliamentarians of different countries who were in support of Tibet. And Lithuanians, two or three Lithuanians had gone and had come back, and they made a report to the public at this, you know, conference we were at. And they were comparing the situation of the Chinese in Tibet with the Russians in Lithuania. And all through the Baltics, you really saw this parallel. So many parallels, you know, and so they really understood the situation of Tibet, you know, being occupied, having foreign people move into your own area and take control, you know, not having the sympathy of the rest of the world, et cetera, being a free country, losing your freedom. But the group we stayed with was such a character. The woman we stayed with was a young writer now, but she used to be a young Soviet writer, you know, and she was real flamboyant with all of her Tibetan things. And her friend was an astrologer who would have fit very well in California, because While I was giving the talk, Mary was sitting next to this astrologer who was saying, "Do you see her aura? She has a very good aura." "Can you read my thoughts? I was just thinking about this. Were you able to read my thoughts?" And I mean, just complete spacing. Lovely people, but spacing. And then the next day I gave a talk, and the people who came to this talk were a lot of the people from this one Buddhist institute in Lithuania. This Buddhist institute was founded by the students of the Lithuanian students who had gone and studied with this one man in Buryatia, who I couldn't get a clear picture on what he was really. They had founded this Buddhist institute, and now they had decided that, you know, they were going to follow Dzogchen, and that was their way. And then the group that organized my teachers, they didn't get along with this group. And again, I found this completely, you know, all throughout the Soviet Union, you know, there's multiple Buddhist groups in the town, and they identify themselves as not being the other one, you know? And so they came to the talk, and so I said to the guy who organized the talk, I said, "Well, they came." He said, "Well, it was just show, it was just appearance." He didn't accept their coming as valid. But these people were apparently people who knew something about Buddhism. But they asked the weirdest question. They asked me if I saw auras. They asked me about identifying different Tibetan traditions and lineages, and, you know, are they the same? Are they really different? Do they teach the same thing? They asked me if Tibetan monks really walk in the sky, and if I had the ability to do tummo meditation in dry sheets in the cold winter. And I mean, and I began to see, and again, this was a pattern throughout the rest of the former Soviet Union, of people seeing Tibetan Buddhism as this weird, mystical, magical thing, because there had been all these scholars from old times who had learned about Tibet. And, you know, Madame Blavatsky, she was Russian. You know, she had communicated with some Tibetan somebody telepathically and written all this stuff. And, you know, different people had gone to Tibet. And all this legend about Shambhala, I mean, the Russians, they loved Shambhala, this Asian paradise in the middle of Asia, you know, and we're all going to go live happily ever after in Shambhala. And, I mean, just what it is like people really seeking some kind of transcendent, far-out experience based on the fact of knowing a few key buzzwords that they had gotten from some book or another, or some person or another. And I really began to see, and I'm kind of making fun of it, you know, but it was really something quite foreign to how I learned Buddhism. Yeah? And yet these people were completely sure that they knew Buddhism. And so this, again, is things that I encountered constantly throughout the former Soviet Union, of people who knew a little but thought they were very knowledgeable, who clung very tenaciously onto their own ideas, who heard a little teachings from one teacher and thought that that was their tradition and the only thing they were ever going to follow and listen to, and who criticized like mad other people. You know, this wasn't the only thing I found going on, but this was a repeated pattern that I found in most of the places I was in. And people just having many, many strange ideas. And the kind of Russian mentality is, you know, you seek a transcendent, they're very kind of mystical people. If you read Dostoevsky and everything, I mean, they're deeply religious, emotional religious people. And the climate there is very hard. You can see why they are seeking a transcendent experience. You know, it's, I'd like to transcend that too. And the climate, I was just in Moscow, there's no sign of spring there. Everything is bleak, like Seattle winter. And so kind of the mind goes off in these elaborate, visionary, far-out things that they love. Huh? So Alex had told me to be sure and ground the people. So I tried to, you know, I tried to like talk about Dharma in daily life. And before I left Seattle, when I went downtown to get my Seattle visa, Steve Wilhelm, he knew when I went to get my Russian visa, Steve Wilhelm from DFF, he knows the consul at the Russian consulate. And so I met him, and he told me that I would meet people like this in the former USSR, that, you know, people were just very spacey, thinking transcendental experience. And he told me I should try and ground them. Yeah. And so, okay, two people told me, I thought this was, I'd better do this. And what they both said was true. I mean, Georgie at the council had said that the market is just flooded now with all sorts of New Age literature, you know. And again, it's exactly what's happening here. But somehow the Buddhist community is more mature here. You know, maybe it is like the Buddhist community 20 years ago or 30 years ago was here. But the whole market is flooded with all sorts of New Age this and that, written by people who don't know a whole lot, or translations from, you know, masters of different traditions. But people, you know, kind of mix it all up together and don't see how to make something in a practical day-to-day tradition. Anyway, it's 9:15 and I've only gotten to Lithuania. So I don't know, maybe should I continue next time? Yeah? Do you want it? Yeah? You don't mind hearing all this blah, blah, blah? Okay.